Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Good day, everybody. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OnFit, and it's my pleasure to be introducing this podcast, which is geared to the Czech National Bank and the monetary policies in the light of the pandemic and all the other challenges that central banks are facing these days. So we have Marek Mora, who is deputy governor of the Central Bank of the Czech Republic. And we then have also Susanna Shirovsky, who is from Scope Ratings, which is a rating agency that spends a lot of time looking at European ratings issues and has got some particularly good ideas on climate change. So thank you very much, both of you, for agreeing to take part in this recording. Now, just turning to you first, Marek, how would you see the main challenges for the Czech Republic, given that we're in a fairly slow growth area here in Europe, which is recovering much less fast than the United States and in China? You have also not adopted some of the more activist monetary policy tools that your fellow central banks have taken, such as an active asset purchase policy. Could you just put that all into context, please, of the way the Czech Republic is performing 1 year after the pandemic?
Yeah, good morning from Prague. Thank you, David. Let me start by saying that the Czech Republic entered the whole COVID crisis from the monetary policy point of view with a quite a comfortable situation. Our inflation actually a year ago was above our target. It was even above the upper limit of our tolerance band, above 3%. And for the whole year 2020, the average annual inflation rate was 3.2%. Whereas our target is 2%. So this was the beginning of the crisis. We acted quite actively from the beginning. We used only our standard policy instruments, which is the interest rate, the two-week repo rate, which we decreased from 2.25% where we were in March last year to 0.25% in May last year. So quite aggressively and quickly. But I must also say that we expected the inflation to decelerate quicker than it did. The inflation rate moved to the tolerance band only in October last year. It has been decelerating, not the whole period since the beginning of the COVID crisis, but more or less the majority of the time it did. Only in October it entered the tolerance band, so quite late. I would expect it to come earlier. And since then, it was on a declining path. We also introduced a number of other measures in the area of macroprudential policy, microprudential policy, which I will not mention here. So this was the starting situation, quite comfortable. We were not forced to use any other instrument apart from the traditional interest rate. And we are now in a situation where we actually don't plan to use it.
Just before we go over to Susanna to ask her about this, Marek, just a quick question about inflation. We are going to see inflation going above 3% in your strong neighboring country of Germany. Are you worried about inflation going well beyond the tolerance level, which might mean that you have to put on the brakes because you'll see bubbles forming in certain industrial sectors or certain sectors of, say, the property market?
We watch this development very, very carefully. We, of course, see the upside risks, mainly stemming from the upcoming recovery in China, in the US, but also from the supply side shortages. We see disrupted supply chains. We see increasing oil prices, energy prices, prices of materials, and we now observe these developments also in the euro area. But there are also quite substantial downside risks, mainly linked to enormous uncertainties linked to the future of the pandemic. We still are not sure if we get it under control and when. You know, it is linked to the rollout of vaccination, to the efficacy of the vaccination towards new mutations of the virus, for instance. But it's also very uncertain how the economic agents will react to the opening up of the economy. What will happen to the accumulated savings of households? How will the companies react to the opening of the economies? How much they are exhausted, both households and the companies? What will be the size of the structural change? We all assume that the new world after COVID will be a different one from the pre-COVID times. So we have all these big uncertainties, including a very huge uncertainty about the output gap, actually. You know, how negative is it, actually? Some people say that maybe it's not negative at all. Maybe the reaction of the central banks at the beginning was exaggerated. So we see all these developments, and we have to be vigilant. But when you ask me if I'm worried about the inflation development, yes, I am, but it's not anything which I think we would not be able to manage. I think we will manage.
Central bankers always have to be worried about something, otherwise we would really be worried. So how do you see all this, Susanna, the balance of risk on the inflation side against also the danger that central banks might not do enough to act, and they should be preparing for our monetary normalization. In fact, they're not doing enough to prepare. What is your view on that, Susanna?
Well, actually, my view and our view as the rating agency is that from credit perspective, the macroeconomic stability and monetary policy are among the strengths of the Czech credit. So in some sense, yes, the Czech National Bank is, in our view, among the more traditional or conservative ones. And Marek also mentioned that basically the non-traditional tools were not used. But on a positive side, I mean, they were not needed. There was still room to use the interest rate. And for countries like Czech Republic, which had a good credibility, they were actually able to lower the interest rate significantly. And it means that they have a higher quality of balance sheet and still credibility. So when they act, they can act more effectively. So overall, I think it's positive. Now, question, of course, price stability is the main goal of the central bank together with the financial stability, but it's not the only one. And of course, growth is on everyone's mind. And that, on the other hand, is weakness of the Czech credit, that for a long time, the growth has been relatively sluggish. I mean, with the exception of the cycle before this COVID crisis, and also the productivity like everywhere else, but also in the Czech Republic has shown some structural decline. But then, of course, question is what should be the central bank doing? And the central bank should be correcting the cyclical gap. And it's not really so much in a business of worrying of the long run growth and the trend growth. So in summary, I think the monetary policies among the strengths of the Czech credit.
How dependent are you, Marek, on what's going on in Frankfurt, and how much do you watch the ECB's monetary policies? You are a member, after all, of the ECB. You are a member of the General Council, although you're not in monetary union itself.
Of course, the ECB policies is one of the key determinants of our policy, because we have to take into account the development of the external environment, and obviously for a small open economy such as the Czech Republic, which is so close to a big giant called the Eurozone, the development of the ECB is of a key importance for us. So we will see how the ECB will react to the overall development. We see more and more maybe voices which go also in the direction of potential future tightening. But a very accommodative monetary policy of the ECB could be a factor which will influence, let's say, the composition of the future monetary tightening in the Czech Republic. What I mean by that is that, it could be a bit a limiting factor for our future interest rate increases. And maybe there will be more tightening going through the exchange rate appreciation. This would be my assessment of the ECB.
How do you see this, Susanna? There's going to be some big decisions which will need to be made in September, I would say. The PEP, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, is due to run out in March. Traditionally, the ECB would have to decide 6 months beforehand what's going to happen on that. What is your feeling about whether the PEP will be extended, because that will have a big implication for the Czech Republic and other countries, as Marek has just said.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, as Marek said, it will depend on where the pandemic is, what really the appropriate response is. But of course, now the risks are on the downside, and there is more worry about the negative impact, and it's after all not only about the economy, it's maybe first of all about human lives, or at least balance between human lives and livelihoods, as is often said. Now, specific to the Czech policy, you know, I would say in some sense it has turned out to be advantage, you know, perhaps to have independent monetary policy and the tools. And in particular, maybe also as is shown in research, that the Czech economy is not particularly perfectly synchronized with the euro area. So to having some degree of independence at this point is a plus.
Marek, could I ask you about this issue of fiscal dominance? We hear a lot of speeches these days by central bankers worrying about potential fiscal dominance because fiscal policy has certainly come back onto the front foot. And there has been a lot of central bank purchases of government debt, not just in the euro area, but worldwide and not in the Czech Republic. Do you think we are at the stage when many systems are facing real life fiscal dominance?
Yes, indeed. Central banks have been forced to use policy instruments which kind of blurred the difference between fiscal and monetary policy. The best example is obviously buying government debt in the quantitative easing programs. I think the risk exists, but I still think that it could be somehow controlled. First, it can be controlled by communication. You have to say all the time that your primary objective is price stability and that you do all these actions to fulfill this primary mandate. And second, of course, it is better if you have a track record which confirms such communication. If you can show that you are a bank aiming at your mandate, which I think is the case of the Czech National Bank, I would, from our point of view, not be very worried about this issue, but that you also show that you are able to return back to normal. So that after a phase of expansion of quantitative easing, there is also a phase of tapering. And on this, I think there is still some work to be done. But I think, as I said, this communication is clear, and maybe also for the future. But maybe now it's too late because many central banks also have a financial stability mandate. But even if they don't, it is somehow part of their job. They should maybe work on this field in a more preemptive manner so that they should maybe raise their voice early enough on the fiscal sustainability issues. Not so much, of course, on the composition of tax revenues or expenditures, but the overall fiscal sustainability is something which maybe the central banks should address as well so that people are aware of it. But I think if you stick to your mandate, to your primary mandate, as we do in the Czech Republic or in the Czech National Bank, and we communicate about it. For instance, recently we communicated that our future step most likely will be an increase in interest rates. This communication was a kind of a wake-up call for our Ministry of Finance and for our government as well, who were not so happy about this, but they understood that these very low costs of financing of their debt will not remain forever, and that something should be addressed or done about the issue of fiscal sustainability. So
it is less complicated as well, isn't it, Marek, if you're performing in a single country monetary state rather than if you have 19 countries to worry about, as Christine Lagarde has to do. But it's absolutely right that from time to time, central banks do have to be rather unpopular with their governments. And we may be approaching that time when, at least for certain people in the Central Bank Council in Frankfurt, they will be approaching a kind of moment of truth. Susanne, if I could just approach this fiscal issue from another angle. We have a very major landmark last year with the Next Generation EU plan agreed last July. Since then, it has run into some difficulties in terms of implementation, not least because of some delays to ratification we see in countries like Germany, but also possibly other countries as well. How worried are you that this attempt to get back onto a much better fiscal monetary mix in Europe might be derailed if the Next Generation EU fund doesn't come on stream as planned.
Okay, yeah. So interesting question. And the next generation EU fund is, of course, important for several reasons, and one of them also being the green recovery, which from our credit point of view is very important. But beyond that, maybe I would like to talk a little bit about this fiscal dominance, which is part also of the monetary fiscal policy mix, because you ask, do we see it in real life? And of course, the answer is absolutely. We see it in many emerging markets and developing countries. In fact, it's more of a rule in those countries than exception. And one advantage that some countries have, like Czech Republic or Estonia, not always to mention Czech Republic, Bulgaria, countries with relatively low debt, it's easier for them to actually resist such fiscal dominance. It becomes much more difficult when the debt is very high, and should the interest rates rise, it would then be more difficult for the monetary policy to act independently, because it starts impacting the interest cost. So that's one direct reason why the fiscal dominance can impact. And maybe one example where government has been really, when the monetary policy also has been carried out very well, is South Africa. So in spite of the rising debt and really very high fiscal costs there of the interest rate, the central bank has maintained in independence, and in fact it has been awarded some notion from the IMF or reward for excellent independent monetary policy. So I think that's one, the most direct link actually of the fiscal dominance that we see.
Perhaps we could go back to you, Barak, on this issue about the Next Generation Fund. Do you believe that this is crossing a Rubicon, that Europe is really getting towards what the German finance minister Olaf Scholz called a Hamiltonian moment?
I think the EU is crossing a Rubicon. I do not necessarily think that it is a crossing in a good direction, because I would still believe that we should stick to the contract which we concluded in back basically in 1992 with the Maastricht Treaty. And all these new trials, when you see that the member states, which are the pillars of the monetary union, when they run out of steam, especially in fiscal policy, and you try to replace them by something above them, which is the EU, or in this case, I mean, it is the EU, but it's mainly, I think, the Eurozone, which ran out of steam on fiscal space. And at the same time, you don't have a political union at the level of the Eurozone. I think it's going to be very difficult. I think it will be a problem in the future. To have a monetary policy in a basically confederation is a challenge.
Yes. Well, this goes back to one of, you might call, the birth defects of monetary union, which is now 30 years old, going back to Maastricht, that you don't have a political union to accompany it. And that's been a long journey. And just before we go back to Susanna to ask about that, do you think that the Next Generation EU fund is going to run into any particular ratification difficulties in the Czech Republic? We've seen some possible holdups elsewhere, but how is it going in the Czech Republic?
No, I do not follow exactly the development, but I think everything is smooth, and I even wonder if it was not already ratified. It will not be an issue, because we also see the Czech government and the Czech Republic sees itself as one of the beneficiaries of this new program.
That is true, but of course and you may well be right, it is true, but of course in Poland you have a very interesting tussle going on, which I won't want you to comment on now, even though Poland will be a major recipient. There's still, as you know, quite a large degree of antipathy. But let's go on to another subject now, Susanna, the climate change issue. You said before that for your credit rating, looking at the green recovery is a very important part of that. What is the role of central banks in general, and where do you think it might play a role for the Czech National Bank in particular regarding policies to combat climate change?
Yeah, well, we have recently written a note on the topic where we compared Czech National Bank, Hungary and Poland, and we identified Hungarian National Bank as being most proactive in this area. And there seems to be a trend, and one could almost say sometimes policies go in the cycle, but this is clearly one of the largest challenges we face. And you know, so in some sense, every institution is called upon to contribute. Now, having said that and having praised before the Czech Central Bank for its credibility, there is a fine trade-off. So I think there is a general consensus now about the role of central bank when it comes to financial stability and the risks that come from climate change. Now, those are, again, it's easy to say there are risks from climate change, and then it's much more difficult to actually cause them in practice, identify them, and even identify very clearly what is brown and what is green industry, because most are continuum. But anyway, it's something that there is progress being made on. And the other area where the central banks can play a role is basically being green themselves and trying to, in their own asset purchases, etc., take this into account. But none of that should happen at the expense of primary objectives. So price stability and, of course, the financial stability. So, I think the conclusion now is, or the consensus is that, yes, central bank have a role to play, but key role in this sense is the government and not the central bank.
Your view on that, Merrick, would be that this is an area where the central bank should approach this with great care, and it could possibly compromise their independence. Would you like to elaborate on that, Merrick?
Yes, I would like to. You know, my view is still the same. I think that, you know, central banks have to work with many risks and long-term trends which have an impact on their policies. You know, it includes the climate change, definitely, but it includes also, for instance, demography, globalization and the rise of China, speed of technological progress, you know, artificial intelligence, information communication technologies. Many of these factors have an impact on the, let's say, on the natural interest rate, on the exchange rates, on relative prices. They might even be disruptive from the financial stability point of view. But does any central bank try to correct these developments? No. Do we try to correct demographic development? We don't. Do central banks have the knowledge to say, even to say that climate change is the biggest and most important among these risks? I don't know. You know, I'm a central banker. It's very difficult for me to say if climate change is a bigger risk than the other risks which I mentioned. Is it the role of a central bank to correct market failures by reallocating resources to or from a certain area of human activity? Big question mark for me. Certainly not under the price stability mandate, as Zuzana rightly said, but to what extent this should be done also under the financial stability mandate is a question mark. Do central banks have the right instruments? Also a big question mark. So my answers to these questions is either no or I don't know, and therefore I think we should not, as central banks, step in this area, and certainly not with the vehemence I see it now. Climate change is an issue with many very difficult trade-offs, and I think that this is primarily for the governments to resolve these trade-offs. They have first much better instruments, I think, than central banks to do so. And second, and maybe even more importantly, the governments have the political mandate and legitimacy to resolve these difficult trade-offs. You know, I am very surprised by this development also in the light of the recent development in central banking. You know, recently many economists said that central banks' policies cannot be the only game in town, especially in the euro area, you know, after the great financial crisis and when we had the sovereign debt crisis. And now these central bankers enter voluntarily a completely new area, which is not so close to our mandate. So I think we as central bankers should not give the impression that our mission is to save the world, and certainly not with this vehemence, which I see now, and which allows, again, the governments to be relieved of their responsibilities, at least partially, I think. So
I think you're not alone in saying that, Merrick. I mean, I even know some people in the German government who agree with you that this is giving too much leeway to the central banks. So thank you for that comment. Susanna, on a specific issue, there's been a big amount of discussion on whether the ECB in its purchases of corporate bonds should somehow step aside from the principle of market neutrality. And as Merrick said, wade into the market themselves and themselves decide what should be the benchmark for purchasing bonds on the grounds that there are a lot of fossil fuel companies or carbon emitters amongst the companies that do issue corporate bonds. So should the ECB in that way move against the principle of market neutrality, Susanna, in its corporate bond purchase program?
Well, if we step a bit back and maybe ask the re-ask the question that Marek posed, which is what are really the functions of government and what are the functions of central banks? So central bank's function is stability, which means cyclical stability and recently also financial stability. Allocative function is not central bank's function. That's function of elective public organs, institutions. So central bank should not really try to play allocative functions. So quick answer to that would be no. Central bank should not be stepping away from principle of market neutrality. But another question here is, has it really been market neutral? Because it has been basically continuing lending. We know that banks have a little bit of bias based on transaction costs to be lending to large corporations, which are perhaps more polluting, etc. So the question is, has it been market neutral to begin with? Or would move towards more green allocation be more market neutral? But as such, really the allocative function is not something that perhaps central bank should have as primary objective.
Marek, there is maybe a common denominator here because people like Mr. Weidmann of the Bundesbank have suggested that the central bank should be limited to purchasing bonds where the companies, they are rated effectively by credit rating agencies which look at the question of emissions, and also that there should be a workable carbon trading program, which will mean that automatically in the marketplace, those bonds would be downgraded, which didn't meet certain conditions. Would you be happy with that, that the central bank, therefore, is not itself imposing some allocative function, but is using market mechanisms and working with the grain of the credit rating agencies to decide what bonds it should theoretically purchase for its portfolio? Would you be happy with that as a compromise formula?
Yes, I would. But of course, for me, the first best solution is that the central banks do not have to enter into these programs at all, like as we did so far in the Czech Republic, because it creates then all these complications, by the way. And we see other issues, let's say in the United States, we see the issue of the employment of some parts of the population, you know, gender issues and some other. So then, you know, once you start doing such policies, you enter into these areas which you probably as a central banker do not want to enter into. Certainly I don't. But this proposal by Jens Weidmann would be certainly much better than what I hear from elsewhere. But then let me also say that according to my knowledge, and my knowledge is based, let's say, on a paper which is now 1.5 years old. It's the Global Financial Stability Report by the IMF, which shows that even these many rating agencies on the ESG, you know, they come up with very different results. It's very difficult really to say what is green or what is ESG or not, because they rate it really very, very differently. So even this market-based solution is better than you know, if it's decided by the central bank itself, but I'm not sure that if we have developed a good, if the market has developed a good benchmark.
Well, it's a good point about uncertainty. For every credit rating agency, there'll be probably three or four different ideas about all this. Susanna, since you're working for a credit rating agency, I won't ask you to comment directly on this, but could you comment on something Marek said just now? He said it's difficult to say what effect climate change will have on risks for central banks, including in their portfolios. So can I put you something that Charles Goodhart, the author, together with Manoj Pradhan, of a book which claims that next year we will see a big increase in inflation. It'll go above the 2% and stay there. He thinks that the damage to portfolios, bond market portfolios all over the world over the next 2 or 3 years as a result of this re-rating of inflation forecast will have a far bigger impact on portfolios in terms of lowering the value of portfolios of bonds that lots of central banks owned, as well as lots of private asset managers, this effect will be far bigger than any effect from climate change in the short to medium run. Would you agree with what Charles Goodhart has said?
Well, I think if I recall, he had a specific demographic theory also behind this claim of rising inflation. So I think it will also depends what we think about the demographics. So he's, you know, some others think that in fact the demographics will push and continue to have a lower inflation. So perhaps the question is how the inflation dynamics will evolve. But no question that the climate change is more of a medium term and longer term effect. But unfortunately, also the measures that you know would prevent it from worsening need to be taken today, and it will take a long time before we see impact. So just because it's a longer term threat doesn't mean that it should be ignored. But again, back who should really play the key role? And it's probably the government with some support, that's our view, from financial stability angle from the central bank.
Yes, on the wider question which we're looking at now, Merrick, which is really what are central banks for, why are they there, and what risks do they face? As you said earlier, there's lots of things you have to look at, ranging from China to artificial intelligence. How important is it that a central bank of a country like the Czech Republic has to have a very good relationship with the central government? For instance, do you have regular coordination meetings on, say, the central bank's issuance programs? And is it possible to reproduce that kind of closeness of association that you might have in your country with the monetary union, where there isn't a central government? How do you see the ECB getting out of the dilemma that there isn't, in fact, a unity of polity in the European Monetary Union area?
Yeah, let's start with the Czech Republic. I mean, we are very independent central bank. We have contacts, communication with the government, but obviously it's more kind of exchange of information. We are in no way dependent on their decisions, so we take them into account, and we also inform them about our decisions. So I think the degree of independence of the Czech National Bank is very, very, very high. But of course, it's easier to let's say act as a central bank within one legal jurisdiction when you have one state, one fiscal policy. In the euro area, of course, it's far more complicated, but as you rightly said earlier, it was known from the very, very beginning. And frankly, if you asked me, I don't know how this dilemma would be resolved, in particular, in the euro area, in particular, where I think, in fact, my understanding is that, in fact, there are kind of two euro areas, the southern and the northern euro area, and how to resolve this problem where you see, you know, the north more or less, with high fiscal discipline, solid economic growth, good productivity, quite competitive economies, and in the south, economies which have problem for a long time, you know, in Italy for 30 years, they have a problem with economic growth, with competitiveness of the industry, with the labor market, follow consequently also with fiscal policies. And it applies also to some other countries in the European South. So how to resolve this issue, I really don't know. But I think it will continue to be one of the major political issues for the euro area. But it will be for politics.
We will get on to the wider development of monetary union in a moment, just as we get towards the end. But just one question for you, Marek, on what you said earlier, before I then go back to Susanna. Is it the job of central banks from time to time in a country like the Czech Republic to have an active disagreement with the government and to indeed be criticized? Is that some way of actually gaining independence to make other people annoyed about you from time to time?
Yes, you are right. It could be, but I think we should not do it just for the sake of disagreeing with the government, just to show how independent we are. We simply should continue saying independently our opinion. And if it creates, you know, a problem for the government or not, it is their problem. If they have a problem, it should not be our worry. So in this sense, we should be independent in our communication. Of course, it is not helpful if the politicians sometimes make comments on our actions, because you know, then it would be maybe necessary to maybe go for even a second best policy just to show your independence. You know, if you get an advice from a politician, if it is a bad advice, you simply do whatever you think is right and you ignore it. But even if it is a good advice, sometimes you do not follow it just to show your independence. And we saw some examples of this in Germany with the Bundesbank under Kohl, for instance. But we have not yet been in such a situation, and hopefully we won't. But we have to. Sometimes it is necessary to show our independence. But I must say that the pressure from the Czech government, from Czech politicians, is not such that we would be in need to show, you know, so demonstratively our independence. It's not such a big
issue. I'm looking forward to a seminar in Prague, Marek, where we will deepen that subject even more. That will be great fun when we get going again. But Susanna, on the question of what are central banks for, what do you think are the main lessons that central banks, not just in Europe, but around the world, have learnt from dealing with the pandemic?
Yes, and then maybe I can add a little bit answering that question actually on this role of independence. So I think fast action is important in the time of crisis, and Czech Central Bank reacted very fast. We also said actually all central banks that we were looking in Central Europe reacted fast and appropriately. So it's not only doing the right thing, but it's doing it at the right time, and right time in time of crisis is quickly. Now, it's a little bit easier to coordinate macro policy, fiscal and monetary policy in the time of crisis, because it's very clear what needs to be done. So so they both are acting to support the economy. Now, more difficult is when there is a different view, but then, as Marek said, basically central banks should have their independent view. They should inform, they should exchange information, but sometimes actually they have a role to correct the so-called wrong fiscal policy. If the fiscal policy is too loose, perhaps the central bank will in fact tighten to provide a better policy mix. What's the right policy mix from the central bank's point of view? And again, central bank is not a political institution. That's why the staff, I mean the governor, deputy governors, etc., have much longer terms, and the independence is very important.
In terms of that question, Marek, about what has one learnt from this, again, going back to the ECB, I remember right at the very beginning, the ECB's view was that the pandemic was something that we should leave to virologists. It wouldn't be something that central bankers had to get too much involved in. And suddenly the story changed in the middle of March 2020. And since then, it's been really number one preoccupation. As we seek to get out of this crisis, it seems to me the longer it goes on, the more likely is that there's going to be a big follow through. The economic crisis will be longer than, say, the health crisis. What is the responsibility of central banks to take into account these lingering economic strains, which may still be with us long after the actual health crisis has disappeared? What is your view on that, Marek?
No, we should definitely, as central bankers, work with these risks. We should try to understand them. I mentioned some of them at the beginning of my intervention, that we see some risks about, you know, how the households and companies will react to the new world once the vaccine gets under control. We don't know how exhausted they will be. We don't know, you know, about the size of the structural change of the economy. We all think there will be a structural shift, but how big and how deep this will be, is a question mark. By the way, I think it's also an issue for these fiscal policies, which support the current economic structures, and maybe this consideration that maybe the phasing out of this support should be rather earlier than later, in order exactly to allow the new structures to come into place, maybe would be in the long term better for the long term growth. So this is something we have to watch. We have to be vigilant about. But I think no one really knows the future. You know, it's a very specific kind of crisis, and I think the economists have very little experience with this kind of economic shock. So I think we will all be very careful with our next steps, and after each step we will assess very carefully what the next step after the next step will be. So the risks are, I think, even bigger than before, because the situation is simply completely new.
But for example, in this new situation we are in, it's the biggest pandemic crisis since more than 100 years now. Are you employing more people in the Czech National Bank who understand about pandemics and so on? Or at least are you trying to make sure that your economists are more up to date with all the scientific literature, or do you continue to rely mostly on advisors and commentators outside the bank for that kind of expertise?
No, we mainly take the expertise from the outside. We didn't hire any extra specialists for the pandemic. We also hope that this will be which will end up one day. So why should we have epidemiologists or someone like this in the central bank? So we rely on external sources.
That seems to be a sensible way of going about it. I just want to end up now in one last question, which I want to put to both of you, and I put it first of all to Susanna. We heard earlier on from Marek talking about how there were really two economic and monetary unions, one north, one south. And it's quite difficult to fit them all together. This has been something which has been going on now for 20 years, and so it's not new. Do you think, Susanna, that the pandemic and the strains that it has revealed in Europe will end up making Europe and the monetary union stronger or weaker?
Well, I think it's hard to say. There were already quite a bit of challenges before the pandemic, and also with this departure of UK, and you saw, I wouldn't say only South, but perhaps the Central European economies have also, like Poland, have their views, etc. But one thing that the pandemic already showed, that when it came to simply dealing with the disease, suddenly, you know, each country to a large extent was on its own, and we saw closure of borders, etc. So I found that the initial reaction a bit surprising. And then what we will see is that the overall increase in risks and much more difficult position for all the individual countries. So we have an increase in contingent liabilities and much higher debt. And then the question is to what extent this debt is sitting in the banking sector. And could we have actually perhaps even another debt crisis in Europe? Now, we are not saying that we see that, but it's something certainly as a rating agency we need to keep in mind and monitor. And of course, if there are such difficulties, they all always cause tension between the countries, who should pay at the end for the cost of repairing of the difficult situation.
I want to ask you the same question, of course, Marek, but just before we get on to that, your near neighbours, the Polish Central Bank, has over the last couple of years spent quite a lot of money in purchasing gold, partly because it feels that is an acceptable way of diversifying their reserves. Your reserve policy has also been quite ambitious and adventurous over the last decade. You've purchased a lot of equities, for example. Do you follow the logic of your neighbours, the Poles, in turning to gold as another way of diversifying the reserves?
Let me start by saying, David, that this accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, which was huge indeed, we have a foreign exchange reserves at the level of some, I think, two-thirds of our GDP, 135 billion euros, about, approximately, which is for a country of our size, a lot. But this was a result of monetary policy. It was a side effect of monetary policy, which was considered at the time when it was introduced back in 2013, a correct monetary policy. So it was not, you know, an aim on its own. It was a side effect of something more important, let's put it this way. So once we have these reserves, we try to allocate them as efficiently as well as we can. But On the gold investment, we are among those central banks who do not see a big value added of having invested in gold, because we don't think it is really an asset. So we are a bit different from many of the colleagues in the region. Now, for instance, from our Polish colleagues.
Well, it's nice to have a bit of diversity. And then to this main question, you spoke about the north-south divide in Europe. Can you be either optimistic or pessimistic about how you think that will develop in, say, the next 5 to 10 years?
No, I think there are only difficult options before the euro area. Either the euro area goes in the direction of its, in my view, original contract, which means strong member states where a common monetary policy can operate quite smoothly. You know, for instance, in my view, if there was theoretically a northern euro area, one would not need any additional, you know, one would not need any fiscal union, any political union. The monetary policy would function well. The reason why we need all these additional pillars is that because there are these differences within the euro area. So one avenue would be to introduce the necessary reforms to increase your competitiveness, to improve your fiscal positions, to make your goods and labor markets more flexible. But we all know that this is very painful. This is not easy. The other option would be to try to create a more federative structure at the European level. But this is, in my view, also very painful and uncertain how this could work. So the euro area is between these two options. Which one is now going to be stimulated by the COVID crisis? I don't know. I would still hope that many national governments would understand the COVID crisis also as a kind of a wake-up call that they have to do something about their national economies in order to improve their competitiveness, which would, you know, profit everyone. It would, you know, the citizens of the country would profit from such a reform. The Eurozone would profit from such a reform. So it would be the win-win solution. But I know that for a politician in this specific country, it will be very difficult. Or we will have this second option to concentrate on only the European structures, which, by the way, could also create a kind of moral hazard problem for these countries, because they would, you know, instead of reforming themselves, they would rely on these federative structures. And this would create, in my view, big tensions between the member states and even within the member states. And we see already some of these things in Germany and in some other countries. So I think the future will be difficult for the euro area.
I'm going to put the same question to Susanna. I will give her the last word in one moment. But just a final question to you, Marek, regarding sometimes making yourself unpopular as a central bank with the finance ministry and with the chancellery. Do you disagree with the government about when and whether and how the Czech Republic should actually join monetary union? And would you say one of the criteria for you joining needs to be that Europe makes up its mind? It either splits up into north or south, or it becomes federated. Would you say that would be an acceptable criterion for whether or not the Czechs should one day join monetary union, that one or other of those two cases should actually be brought about?
Yeah, you're posing, David, very difficult questions, I must say. On the first part, if we have a disagreement or not with the government on the euro area adoption strategy, we don't. Our government is not in favor of entering into the euro area. We also do not see any extra benefit from this, so we are not in favor of that either. But let's see if the situation changes. You know, we will have elections in October this year, and there might be a new government with new visions, we will see. But we always acknowledge as a central bank that this is primarily a political decision. So it is mainly for the government, for the politicians to decide on this. As if you ask me, on the second part of your question, what would be the condition? I belong to those people who think, you know, I don't want to somehow give the impression that I'm not humble or modest enough, but I still think that the Czech Republic, if we decided to enter the euro area, we would somehow manage, I think. and we would not probably belong to the weakest part of the euro area. But for me, the more important thing is, as you rightly said, is the sustainability of the euro area. And there I see some problems. I don't want to go as far as to say that I would be in favor only if the euro area splits in two parts or something like this. I would like to see the euro area to be much more sustainable than it is now. And in my view, the best way to achieve this would be if the national economies, especially in south of the Europe, would become more sustainable, which I know it's a difficult thing to do. But then I would have no problem, basically, to join.
Thank you. And Susanna, last word for you. What is your answer to that conundrum that I just put to Marek? Well, also whether to make itself ready for more solvent countries, shall we say, to the east, the monetary union does need to get itself into a fit state. Either it has to decide it's going to be a much more homogeneous area, which maybe would lead to some countries leaving, or it's got to bring about sufficient reforms to make the present membership more equitable, and also form some kind of federation to make itself, if you like, fit for countries like the Czech Republic or Poland or Sweden or Denmark to actually join.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely I think Marek made important point about the competitiveness. When I was answering before, I simply had in mind that actually the competitiveness as such would not improve. So I was talking about the fiscal transfers and how difficult then that is actually, that the stronger countries in some say pay for the mistakes of the weaker one in such a situation. But of course there is another option. It's more flexible product and labor markets. And by labor market flexibility, you would say also much bigger movements across the countries and the movements of labor kind of mitigating the differences across countries. So much more. And we have, of course, formally the barriers are not there within the EU, but informally the language, the culture, etc. It is still not so easy for people relocating, let's say, relative to United States. Europe has much more labor movement. Now for the Czech Republic, I also agree. Basically, I mean, Czech Republic committed by joining EU that at some point it will adopt euro. Now, when at some point, if crisis showed us something, it's probably that having monetary independence was a good thing and another tool to manage the economy. And if the Czech Republic, from the Czech point of view, if it joins, it should be joining strong union, of course. So it will be a strong, solid member with very good monetary policy before and overall strong and solid macro policies and one of the lowest debt. So it should also be wanting to be joining a strong community. Now, I think purely technically the analysis that Czech Central Bank conducts every year on shock synchronization shows that, you know, there is no compelling reason to be joining. But again, as Marek said, it's a political decision. And that's also very important. And it's not purely economic decisions. So, but when the time will be right, the future will tell.
Well, I think we can leave it open at that. It is work in progress. I've got a feeling there's going to be many more podcasts on this issue before we actually get to that decision-making state. So I'd like to thank you both very much, Marek Mora from the Czech National Bank, Deputy Governor, and Susanna Sirotsky from Scope Rating Agencies for taking us through this hour of talk about the Czech Republic, but also much more widely, the future direction of central banking and indeed of the European Monetary Union project. This is David Marsh from Office signing off. Thank you very much for listening and do listen to us again soon. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.